So I want to read something to you from Irma Bombeck. It says, what does a father do? It says, I received a letter from a single mother who had raised a son who was about to become a dad. Since he had no recollection of his own father, her question was to me, what do I tell them a father does, or tell him a father does? My dad died in my 9th year, and so I too was raised by my mother, giving rise to the same question, what do fathers do? As far as I could observe, they brought around the car when it rained so everyone else could stay dry. They always took the family pictures, which is why they were never in them. They carved turkeys on Thanksgiving, kept the car gassed up, weren't afraid to go in the basement, mowed the lawn, tightened the clothesline to keep it from sagging. It wasn't until my husband and I had children I was able to observe firsthand what a father contributed to a child's life. What did he do to deserve his children's respect? He rarely fed them. Did anything about their sagging diapers, wiped their noses or fannies, played ball, or bonded with them under the hoods of their cars. What did he do? He threw them higher than his head until they were weak from laughter. He cast the deciding vote on the puppy debate. He listened more than he talked. He let them make mistakes. He allowed them to fall from their first two-wheeler without having a heart attack. He read a newspaper while they were trying to parallel park for the first time in preparation for their driving test. If I had to tell someone's son what a father really does that is important, it would be that he shows up for the job in good times and bad times. He's a man who is constantly being observed by his children. They learn from him how to handle adversity, anger, disappointment, and success. He won't laugh at their dreams, no matter how impossible they might seem. He will dig out at 1 a.m. when one of his children runs out of gas. He will make unpopular decisions and stand by them. When he is wrong and makes a mistake, he will admit it. He sets the tone for how family members treat one another, members of the opposite sex, and people who are different than they are. By example, he can instill a desire to give something back to the community when its needs are greater than theirs. But mostly, a good father involves himself in his kids' lives. The more responsibility he has for a child, the harder it is to walk out of his life. A father has the potential to be a powerful force in the life of a child. Grab it. Maybe you'll get a greeting card for your efforts, maybe not, but it's steady work. I thought that was pretty good, and, you know, it gives a good picture of what a father does in general. Like it was said, you know, the ladies a lot of times are the caretakers day in and day out of the children, not always, but they're there a lot of the times, and the man has a different role, and that's the way God set it up. And but it's a very important one. Both are so important. And when they mesh together the way God intended, then the family goes the way it's supposed to. So I just want to touch on a few things about fathers. And we'll just, you know, like I said, God's our father. And so as we look at these things, we can think about him as our father and how that relates. You know, God created the man and the woman, when they come together in marriage, to have certain roles, like I said, and those are really images of parts of him. They're parts of God's character. We both men and women have strengths in areas that are different parts of who God is. And so we can see an image. What God tells fathers to do, he would never tell a father or a mother to do something that he himself wouldn't do. Let's turn to Luke 15:11. Pretty familiar story there. Luke 15:11. So it says that this is the story of the prodigal son. And it says there, then he said, Jesus, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided to them his livelihood. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. And when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in the land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I will perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to be merry. And his older son was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house. He heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf.' But he was angry and would not go in. Therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, 'Lo, these many years I have been serving you. I have never transgressed your commandment any time, and yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found.'" So there's many things there, and there's just a couple different things we're going to touch on, and then some other scriptures. But, you know, that's a familiar story. This son gets to the point where he asks for his father's inheritance. His father had to know that his son wasn't ready to receive that inheritance. If he was a good father at all, he knew where his son was at. He knew the son wasn't going to be able to handle it. Yet he gave the inheritance anyway because the son was old enough. And I'll just wait. No, I'll just wait until you guys are... You guys need to bring her back or anything?
Well, I'm going to stay with Shelly
for a bit. Oh, okay. Yeah, dealing with a baby in the middle of service. It's challenging. All right, so the son asked for this inheritance, took it, went and blew it. I mean, you think of how much... I don't know if this guy was really wealthy or whatever, but he had servants. You know, blew all that, then came back. And like I said, even though the father probably knew that he wasn't ready for it, he gave it to him. He let him make his own decision there because he was mature enough to. It was his right, I guess, to have the inheritance. He went off, he made poor decisions. Then he wasted all his money. Then he's sitting there completely poor, doesn't have any money. Goes and is a servant for some other man in a foreign country, you know, taking care of pigs. And then finally wakes up and says, wait, you know, people that are serving my father as servants, they eat better and do better than me. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to be a servant. I mean, at least I'll be doing better than I am now if I just go and be a servant. So he goes back and, you know, before he even gets there, his father runs out to see him. Is glad to see him. The son, of course, you know, you might imagine a young man. He's blown it. He's idealistic, thinks he's going to go out and conquer the world, blows all his money, messes up, comes back. Now he's got this apology all prepared. He starts talking, saying, oh, I'm not worthy to be your son. And his dad just gives him a big hug and says, bring out the fatted calf, my son's home. You know, He wasn't discounting what his son was doing, but he realized probably his son made a mistake, just like young men do. You know, you have your apology and whatever, but you don't understand the bigger picture here. I mean, I'm just so glad that you're here. The son wanted to say, you know, talk about his what he should have done and how sorry he was and whatever, but the father just gave him a big hug, and then you know, threw a party for him. He was so happy. And then you have the part about the other son. But right there, I mean, when we look at, number one, how a father is with his children, like that opening story said, you know, when a father can be practicing for a driving test, which I'm not there yet, but, you know, like my dad would have. And he's not ruffled by the the fact that the kid's learning to drive. I mean, that he's not falling off his chair when, you know, the child wrecks on a bike. The child's growing up. He's supposed to do those things. He's supposed to be wherever he's at. He's going to make mistakes. You're not expecting him to be perfect. And, you know, just like this man, I mean, on a higher scale, this guy went out and blew all his money. That father could have been just so indignant and ruffled and beat his son up when he came back. But, I mean, if we're all honest, we all do stupid stuff at different points in our lives, and we'll make stupid mistakes from here forward. So when we look at our kids and just treat them like kids, even if they're big kids, and at least have a loving heart towards them, a patient heart, and not beat them up for making the mistakes that we probably made. You know, a father is supposed to be the calm, cool, and collective. Not that the woman's not, but there's just he's just a presence there, like God is a presence there. He watches us make mistakes. I mean, sometimes if we get on our kids for stuff like they're supposed to be perfect, and then we can turn right around at that point and say, what? It helps me sometimes. You know, you think about, well, what am I doing that I'm really not supposed to be doing? Where am I falling short that I'm trying to do better, but I'm not? When it concerns God, and how is He looking at me? Is He looking at me like I'm feeling like I want to, you know, treat my children right now, or, you know, act like you should have it all together? Like, why don't you have it together? When I myself, if I wouldn't want that turned on me, I don't have it all together. God knows I don't have it all together. Yet He's more like this man, which this is a picture of God. We go and blow it. We've messed stuff up. But God is more concerned with just having a relationship with us and with us being in the right family, being with Him, to know what Jesus did and just to be there with Him. He's not concerned with if you did everything right or wrong. And that goes to the second son. That second son was saying, look, I've been here all this time. I've worked. I've done everything I'm supposed to do, and you've never given me anything to party with my friends. You've never given anything to me. I've done everything right. But then you hear this son comes home and he's gone and messed up all these things, and he comes home and here you've killed the fatted calf for him. And that's a lot like religion does. You know, I've done this, I've done that, I've served you, I've served God, and God's not given anything to me. But, you know, here's somebody has wrecked their whole life and then comes in and realizes what Jesus did for him and comes in and just receives the love of God. And here doesn't feel like he has to pay for everything he did wrong. But I've been here faithful. Well, there's benefits to being faithful your whole life. Probably, I mean, I don't think that kid came out unscarred or, you know, by doing what he did. He didn't get off scot-free by going and blowing his whole inheritance and whatever. If he blew it on harlots and whatever, he's got stuff that he's going to live with for the rest of his life. You know, into his family and whatever that he messed up on. There's benefits to living right, but we don't put that over what only Jesus could do in our relationship with Him. And as a father, God looks at us and He wants us to do right, just like we want our children to do right. He wants us to do well, because I mean, that father didn't want the child to go off and blow his inheritance and wait. I mean, he could have done so much more with that money. He could have done so much more with his life at that point. He didn't want him to do that, but that wasn't the end all be all his performance. It was did he have a relationship with his father? His father was so happy just to see him and to just be with him. And you know, we just have to keep a perspective, whether we're fathers or mothers or whatever, in whatever stage our children are in life, that we treat them like God would treat us. And if there's anything I would just emphasize today, it's just patience and not beating them up for things or hanging something over them that should not be there, like something that we would not want hung over our own head. Not that we don't expect good things of our kids. Not that we're sloppy. Because we want to set high standards for our kids and we want them to do well because that's going to be the best for them. Just like God wants us to do well and He wants the best for us. But the thing that will get us, just like, you know, we've talked about many times, the thing that is going to get us to the place that we want to be is knowing that God's behind us, he's for us, that he is there, and that he is rooting for us, not that he's constantly beating us up every time we try and fail. That makes us want to quit. That destroys our spirit. And that's what religion does, is it destroys a spirit. Because they look at God the Father the wrong way. They look at God the Father the way an abusive father would be. They look at it as somebody that's just this hard taskmaster that's never pleased with anything. And that Jesus himself told this parable to illustrate what God the Father was like. And this father was not like that. If anybody had a reason to be mad at their child, this man did. But he did not read him the riot act. Even when the kid came to apologize, he just loved him. The child knew what he did wrong. He knew it. He just wanted to be a servant. He was ready just to be a servant in his father's house. But his father came. He knew that he was sorry. He knew he blew it. He knew he learned his lesson. He just loved him. He comforted him. He could have broken that kid for life at that point. The kid comes back. He's already known he's blown it. He doesn't have any money to go, you know, to just bury his sorrows in and go party anymore. He's come. He's hit a brick wall. He's run into the wall. He's run out of money. He doesn't have any food. He's got a wake up call. So he comes home to his father, just hoping to be a servant. His father could have just wrecked him right there, destroyed his spirit, and crippled him for the rest of life, but he didn't. He loved him. He took him back, and he threw a party for him. And we don't know what, it was a story, so we don't see what came after that. But that's encouraging to the child. I mean, if he's learned his lesson, now he's got a second chance. Now he can do something with it. And there's a couple instructions to fathers, and this is the same, again, the same way God treats us that I want to read. If you turn to Ephesians 6:4. And this applies, it says to fathers, but it applies just as much to women, the same type of instructions. You know, in some households, there isn't. Like Irma Bombeck grew up in a house where there wasn't a father, so the mother's got to do the same thing, and this applies. There's a couple scriptures here. In Ephesians 6:4, it says there, "You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in training and admonition of the Lord." Fathers, you do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in training and admonition of the Lord. Now let's turn to Colossians 3:21, which says about the same thing. And then I'll read a couple other things. Colossians 3:21 says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged." And what that means, "do not provoke your children," means this. Provoke means to irritate or discourage children by harsh yelling, nagging, or deriding their efforts. Such provocations wound their spirits and make them timid. They become discouraged. That's what it's talking about. I'll read that one more time. It says, provoke here means to irritate or discourage children by harsh yelling, nagging, or deriding their efforts. Such provocations wound their spirits and make them timid. They become discouraged. So when he says, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged, he's saying, don't nag your children, yell at them, and put down their efforts. It's tempting to do that. I think it's out of a heart that, like I said, this applies to both men and women, but as parents, it's tempting because you want the child to succeed so much. And we can think back to our own parents. And I see it so much different now that I'm a parent and I see my reactions in certain areas. And I think back to my parents. Your parents and we as parents want our children to succeed, that it's tempting just to stay on them and basically nag them or to try to direct them, over-direct them. Because they, you know, correct this, correct that. You know, try to get them to do this better and do that better. Like you're trying to make this perfect, this perfect behavior. But if a child's not allowed to grow in different things and keep adding as they grow, you know, they don't ever get there because they're constantly being weighed with more requirements. You know, it'd be like trying to teach a kid to play baseball. And what my friend said this one time, you don't start with how to, you know, take a cutoff throw from the outfield, or, you know, how to cover, the pitcher's supposed to cover first base when, you know, the first baseman has to field a ball. They don't know what you're talking about. If you don't know baseball, you probably don't know what I'm talking about either, because those are things that people learn as they learn the game of baseball. What they started out with, you know, what they start out with when you go and learn baseball is, here's first base, here's second base, here's third base. Now they just run them and try to touch the base. They don't even really care if you touch the base. Just that's where first base is, that's where second base is, that's where third base is, here's home. Now run them. They don't talk about, you know, what to do in different situations. If they did, it'd blow the kid's mind. And you know what he'd probably do? Say, forget baseball. I don't want to play baseball. It's too hard. Because you're trying to stuff this information into a five-year-old. Well, how much is it tempting to do that with children or young children, you know, adults or whatever, anybody in our life, to try to, we really care for the person. But if we're not careful, we unintentionally can wound their spirits and discourage them because we're trying too much, trying to get them too much into them when they're not ready for it, and it just overloads us. I mean, think about it. We're like this. God is not like this to us. But if God were to tell you everything that you're supposed to be doing perfectly, I mean, he does in his word, but get on you for changing it right now, everything right now, today, this afternoon, you better get your act shaped up. And I'm going to tell you, you know, everything that you're supposed to be doing, get snapped right now. You probably throw up your hand and say, I can't do it. I'm not good enough to do it. Well, that's why Jesus came, is so that we weren't judged by the law and the righteous requirement of the law, that we are judged by Jesus. That's the standard. That is a standard. It's the right standard, but it's impossible for anybody to live perfectly like that. And so God sent Jesus so that we could be justified by faith and yet stand in his presence in a holy God and still feel okay. And yet he treats us like this, and he brings us along, and he knows exactly what we need to work on and what we can handle, and he quickens into us what we should be doing. And he doesn't overload us, and he's perfect. He knows exactly what we need, yet that's how he treats us. So if the perfect God, the perfect Father acts that way, perfect parent, if you want to say it that way, that's what we ought to strive for. Looking at our children with love and tenderness, realizing that they are growing, just like we're growing, and that by overdoing it, even if it's well-intentioned, they can take it as they're being attacked or nagged to do something, even though we have the right intention. It just comes to being led by the Spirit of God. Somebody said this to me once. It impacted my life. I was talking to a guy. And, you know, he said, you are the parent of your child, and God will lead you in how to train them. Not your friends or not somebody else. You be led by the Spirit of God in how to train your child, because God, nobody has a more vested interest in your child than you. You are the parent. There might be some book, there might be somebody else's advice, wherever, you know, whatever stage of life they're in, but he will lead each of us. We are the ultimate authority on our children because we have the responsibility for raising them. God is not going to tell somebody down the street or even somebody else in church. He may help, you know, direct us. That'll bear witness with us, and we can utilize it. But the ultimate authority in our children's life and ultimate responsibility is us, regardless of what phase they're in, regardless if they're adults or wherever they're at. We have the responsibility, and nobody else does. Giving advice is really cheap. You know, but to live it and to live with the consequences is not. And so we have the responsibility. So who's God going to lead? And if we feel like, you know, I'll give you an example. And this, I mean, doesn't apply to some of you don't have young children anymore. But it's the same thing, I guess, that illustrates that principle, is that just being led and being conscious of what we feel like we're supposed to do when it comes to our children or any situation. This man, he just did not feel good I think there was this Christian school, and they just did not feel good about sending their kids to this Christian school. And they thought that, you know, they're like, people are saying, you should go there and whatever. And they didn't. And there was just some things where they were wondering, why are we doing this? But we just don't feel right about it. They couldn't figure out a reason why they shouldn't do it. But it was in that time period that then later that there was it came to light that there was people being molested in that time in that school. And you know, God was warning whoever was involved the same thing. But sometimes we override that because we listen to somebody else's advice or we look to something else on the exterior and say, we disregard it because something on the exterior just makes us disregard. We don't know why, since we don't have a reason, we disregard what is going on in here instead of just listening to it and being led in our parenting or whatever other situation. And in that case, I mean, they were so thankful that they didn't put their children in harm's way like that. So anyway, it says, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. And so we don't want to discourage them. We don't want to actually cripple them by our actually well-intentioned efforts. In Proverbs, you don't have to turn there. This is real quick. Proverbs 18:14 says, the spirit of man will sustain him in sickness, but who can bear a broken spirit? You know, if you have a strong spirit, if you know that God loves you, know your parents love you in the child's case, you can go through things and come out another side. But if you have a broken spirit, if you're discouraged, if you don't feel like you're going to... That people don't love you, or that you're not going to make it, or you just generally discouraged. It doesn't matter what comes. You don't necessarily have the strength to go through it, and that's the last thing we would want to do to any loved one in our. It goes with, you know, any relationship, brothers, sisters, spouses, whatever. The more encouraging and loving and patient we are with the people around us, the more like God we are, and that's what it all comes down to. I mean. Everything in the Bible, we could just boil it down to say, you know, if we have God-like character, we'll do okay. Whether we talk about it on Father's Day, whether we talk about it on Mother's Day, we talk about it on Grandparents' Day, Thanksgiving, Christmas, you know, Valentine's Day. It's all fast. It's just like taking a diamond and looking at it from different angles. You know, when we talk about it on Valentine's Day, we're talking about it between two people that are in marriage. But what are we talking about? Loving them like God loves us. We talk about Christmas. People talk about the Christmas spirit. Well, and then even people in the secular will say, well, we should have that all year. Well, of course, if we're looking at Jesus, we will have that attitude all year because we're looking at how he loves us. Same thing with mothers, fathers. It's all just basically treating other people the way God treats us. And the more we get to know God, the more we really get to know God for who he really is and not what religion has told us he is, the more then we see that reflected in our own life. And then we know how God looks at us, and it's easier to say, well, I'm going to treat somebody else like that because I have somebody treating me like that. And that makes it easier to bear with people when they're just ugly. You know, they do something dumb like we do. And when we can look past that and say, you know, Jesus did the same thing for me, even though I didn't do everything right.